the hole once he'd gotten it onto the green, and so on. Not only did the numbers let him see which areas needed work and what sort of work was needed, they served as the mileage markers on his road to golf expertise. As anyone familiar with golf knows, the most important indicator of Dan's progress is his handicap. The formula for calculating the handicap is somewhat complicated, but in essence it tells you how good a game Dan could be expected to play on one of his better days. Someone with a handicap of 10, for example, is assumed to be able to play 18 holes of golf at 10 strokes over par. The handicap makes it possible for players at different ability levels to play on something approaching an even footing. And because one's handicap is based on scores over the previous 20 or so full rounds of golf one has played, it is constantly changing and provides a record of how well a person has been playing over time. When Dan first started calculating and recording his handicap in May 2012, it was 8.7, which was quite good for someone who'd been playing just a couple of years. By the second half of 2014, his handicap was fluctuating between 3 and 4, which was truly impressive. At this writing, in the second half of 2015, Dan was recovering from an injury that had set him back and kept him from playing for a while. He had put in more than 6,000 hours of practice, so he was more than 60% of the way to his goal of 10,000 hours of practice. We still don't know if Dan will achieve his goal of playing on the PGA Tour, but he has clearly shown how a 30-year-old man with no real golf experience can, with the right sort of practice, turn himself into an expert golfer. My inbox is full of stories like this. A psychotherapist from Denmark who used deliberate practice to develop her singing and eventually recorded songs that have gotten airplay on radio stations all over Denmark. A mechanical engineer from Florida who developed his painting skills through deliberate practice and sent me a picture of his first ever painting, which was really quite good. A Brazilian engineer who decided to devote 10,000 hours, that number again, to becoming an origami expert. And so on. The only two things that all these people have in common are that they all have had a dream and that they've all realized, after learning about deliberate practice, that there is a path to achieving that dream. And this, more than anything else, is the lesson that people should take away from all these stories and all this research. There is no reason not to follow your dream. Deliberate practice can open the door to a world of possibilities that you may have been convinced were out of reach. Open that door. Chapter 7. The Road to Extraordinary. In the late 1960s, the Hungarian psychologist Laszlo Polgár and his wife Clara embarked on a grand experiment that would consume their lives for the next quarter century. Laszlo had studied hundreds of people who were considered geniuses in one field or another, and he'd concluded that with the proper rearing, any child could be turned into a genius. When he was wooing Clara, he outlined his theories and explained that he was looking for a wife who would collaborate with him to test his theories on their own children. Clara, a teacher from Ukraine, must have been a very special woman, for she responded positively to this unorthodox courtship and agreed to Laszlo's proposals for marriage and for turning their future children into geniuses. Laszlo was so sure his training program would work for any area that he wasn't picky about which particular one he and Clara would target, and the two of them discussed various options. Languages were one option. Just how many languages might it be possible to teach a child? Mathematics was another possibility. Top-flight mathematicians were highly regarded in Eastern Europe at the time, as the communist regimes sought ways to prove their superiority over the decadent West. Mathematics would have the added advantage that there were no top-level female mathematicians at the time, so assuming that he and Clara had a daughter, Laszlo would prove his claim even more convincingly. But he and Clara settled on a third option. "We could do the same thing with any subject, if you start early, spend lots of time, and give love to that one subject," Clara would later tell a newspaper reporter. "But we chose chess. Chess is very objective and easy to measure." Chess had always been thought of as a game for the male mind, with female chess players treated as second-class citizens. The women had their own tournaments and championships because it was thought it wouldn't be fair to put them up against the men, and there had never been a female grandmaster. Indeed, at the time, the common attitude toward women playing chess was much like Samuel Johnson's famous quote, "A woman preaching is like a dog's walking on his hind legs. It is not done well, but you are surprised to find it done at all." The Pulgars were blessed with three children, all of them girls, all the better to prove Laszlo's point. Their first daughter, born in April 1969, was named Susan, in Hungarian Zuzana. Sophia, Zofia, followed in November 1974, and then Judit in July 1976. Laszlo and Clara homeschooled their daughters in order to spend as much time as possible focusing on chess. It didn't take long for the Pulgars' experiment to become a tremendous success. Susan was just 4 years old when she won her first tournament, dominating the Budapest Girls Under-11 Championship with 10 wins, no losses, and no ties. At 15, she became the top-ranked woman chess player in the world, and she went on to become the first woman to be awarded grandmaster status via the same path that the males must take. Two other women had been named grandmasters after winning female-only world championships. And Susan wouldn't even be the most accomplished of the girls. Sophia, the second daughter, also had an amazing chess career. Perhaps its highlight came when she was only 14, when she dominated a tournament in Rome that included several highly regarded male grandmasters. By winning 8 of her 9 games and drawing the 9th, she earned a single tournament chess rating, which is a rating based only on the games of that tournament, of 2735, which was one of the highest tournament ratings ever for either a male or female player. That was in 1989, and people in the chess world still talk about the sack of Rome. Although Sophia's highest overall chess rating was 2540, well over the 2500 threshold for grandmaster, and although she had performed more than well enough in sanctioned tournaments, she was never awarded grandmaster status, a result that was apparently more a political decision than a judgment about her chess prowess. Like her sisters, she had never tried to make nice with the male chess establishment. Sophia was at one time the 6th-ranked female chess player in the world. Among the Pulgar sisters, though, she could be considered the slacker. Judit was the crown jewel of Laszlo Pulgar's experiment. She became a grandmaster at 15 years, 5 months, making her at that time the youngest person, male or female, to ever reach that level. She was the number 1-ranked women's chess player in the world for 25 years, until she retired from chess in 2014. At one time, she was ranked number 8 in the world among all chess players, male or female. And in 2005, she became the first and so far only woman to play in the overall World Chess Championship. The Pulgar sisters were all clearly experts. Each of them became among the very best in the world in an area in which the measured performance is extremely objective. There are no style points in chess. Your school background doesn't matter. Your resume doesn't count. So we know, without any doubts, just how good they were, and they were very, very good. And while some details of their background are unusual, very few parents are so focused on turning their children into the best in the world at something, they provide a clear, if somewhat extreme, example of what it takes to become an expert performer. The paths that Susan, Sophia, and Judit took to chess mastery are in line with the path that essentially all experts have taken to become extraordinary. In particular, psychologists have found that an expert's development passes through 4 distinct stages, from the first glimmers of interest to full-fledged expertise. Everything we know about the Pulgar sisters suggests that they went through those same stages, if perhaps in a slightly different fashion because of how their father directed their development. In this chapter, we take an in-depth look at what it takes to become an expert performer. As I explained earlier, most of what we know about deliberate practice has come from the study of experts and how they develop their extraordinary abilities. But to this point in the book, we have focused mainly on what this all means for the rest of us, those of us who may use the principle of deliberate practice to get better, but who may never be among the best in the world at what we do. Now, we switch our attention to those best-in-the-world sorts. The world-class musicians, the Olympic athletes, the Nobel Prize-winning scientists, the chess grandmasters, and the rest. In one sense, this chapter could be thought of as a how-to manual for creating an expert, a roadmap to excellence, if you will. This chapter won't give you everything you'll need to produce the next Judit Polgar or Serena Williams, but you will leave it with a much better idea of what you're signing on to, if that's the route you choose. More broadly, this chapter provides a step-by-step look at what is required to take full advantage of human adaptability and reach the frontier of human capabilities. Typically, that process begins in childhood or early adolescence, and proceeds for a decade or more until the expert level is reached. But it doesn't stop there. One of the hallmarks of expert performers is that even once they become one of the best at what they do, they still constantly strive to improve their practice techniques and to get better. And it is here, at the frontier, that we find the pathbreakers, those experts who go beyond what anyone else has ever done and show us all what is possible to achieve. Starting out. In a magazine interview, Susan Polgar spoke about how she first got interested in chess. "I found my first chess set when I was looking in the closet at home for a new toy," she said. "I originally was attracted to the shape of the figures. Later, it was the logic that fascinated me, and the challenge." It is interesting to note the difference between Susan's memory of how she got interested in chess and what we know about her parents' plans for her. Laszlo and Clara had already decided that Susan would become a top-ranked chess player, so they would have hardly counted on her just happening to find the chess pieces and becoming fascinated with them. The precise details are not important, however. What is important is that Susan became interested in chess as a child, and that she became interested in the only way that a child of that age, she was 3 at the time, could become interested. She saw the chess pieces as fun, as a toy, as something to play with. Young children are very curious and playful. Like puppies or kittens, they interact with the world mostly through play. This desire to play serves as a child's initial motivation to try out one thing or another, to see what is interesting and what is not, and to engage in various activities that will help them build their skills. At this point, they're developing simple skills, of course, arranging chess pieces on a chessboard, throwing a ball, swinging a racket, organizing marbles by shape or pattern. But for future experts, this playful interaction with whatever has caught their interest is their first step toward what will eventually become their passion. In the early 1980s, the psychologist Benjamin Bloom directed a project at the University of Chicago that asked a simple question. What does one find in the childhood of people who become experts that explains why they, among all people, develop such extraordinary abilities? The researchers working with Bloom chose 120 experts in 6 fields: concert pianists, Olympic swimmers, tennis champions, research mathematicians, research neurologists, and sculptors, and looked for common factors in their development. This study identified 3 stages that were common to all of them, and that indeed appear to be common to the development of expert performers in every area, not just the 6 fields that Bloom and his colleagues examined. In the first stage, children are introduced in a playful way to what will eventually become their field of interest. For Susan Polgar, it was finding the chess pieces and liking their shapes. In the beginning, they were nothing more than toys to play with. Tiger Woods was given a little golf club to hold when he was just 9 months old, again a toy. In the beginning, a child's parents play with their child at the child's level, but gradually they turn the play toward the real purpose of the toy. They explain the special moves of the chess pieces. They show how the golf club is used to hit the ball. They reveal the piano's ability to produce a tune rather than just a racket. At this point, the parents of children who are to become experts play a crucial role in the child's development. For one thing, the parents give their children a great deal of time, attention, and encouragement. For another, the parents tend to be very achievement-oriented and teach their children such values as self-discipline, hard work, responsibility, and spending one's time constructively. And once a child becomes interested in a particular field, he or she is expected to approach it with those same attributes: discipline, hard work, achievement. This is a crucial period in a child's development. Many children will find some initial motivation to explore or try something because of their natural curiosity or playfulness. And parents have an opportunity to use this initial interest as a springboard to an activity. But that initial curiosity-driven motivation needs to be supplemented. One excellent supplement, particularly with small children, is praise. Another motivation is the satisfaction of having developed a certain skill, particularly if that achievement is acknowledged by a parent. Once a child can consistently hit a ball with a bat, say, or play a simple tune on the piano, or count the number of eggs in a carton, that achievement becomes a point of pride and serves as motivation for further achievements in that area. Bloom and his colleagues found that often the experts in their study had picked up the particular interests of their parents. Parents who were involved in music, whether as performers or ardent listeners, often found their children developing an interest in music, as it was a way they could spend time with the parents and share the interest. Ditto for parents who immersed themselves in sports. The parents of children destined for more intellectual pursuits, such as the future mathematicians and future neurologists, were more likely to discuss intellectual topics with their kids, and they emphasized the importance of school and learning. In this way, the parents, at least the parents of children who would go on to be experts, shaped the interests of their children. Bloom reported no cases like the Polgars, in which the parents set out consciously to push their children in a particular direction. But it doesn't have to be conscious. Simply by interacting with their children, parents motivate their children to develop similar interests. In this first stage, the children don't practice per se, that will come later. But many children do manage to come up with activities that are part play, part training. A good example is Mario Lemieux, widely considered to be one of the best hockey players to ever take the ice. He had two older brothers, Alain and Richard, and the three of them would regularly go down to the basement of the family home, where they would slide around on their socked feet as if on ice skates and knock a bottle cap around with wooden kitchen spoons. Another is the British hurdler David Hemery, one of the best British track athletes ever, who turned many of his childhood activities into competitions with himself, challenging himself to constantly improve. When given a pogo stick for Christmas, for example, he stacked telephone books in order to practice jumping over obstacles. Although I don't know of any studies that look at the value of this sort of play practice, it seems likely that these children were taking their first steps down the path toward expertise. Mario Lemieux's experience points up another salient feature of prodigies' early experience. How many of them had older siblings to be inspired by, to learn from, to compete with, and to model themselves after? Judit Polgar had Susan and Sophia. Wolfgang Mozart had Maria Anna, who was 4.5 years older, and who was already playing harpsichord when Wolfgang first became interested in music. Tennis great Serena Williams followed in the footsteps of her sister Venus Williams, who was herself one of the best tennis players of the current era. Michaela Schifrin, who became the youngest slalom champion in history during the Olympic Games in 2014, had an older brother, Taylor, who was a competitive skier. And so on. This is yet another sort of motivation. A child who sees an older sibling performing an activity and getting attention and praise from a parent will naturally want to join in and garner some attention and praise as well. For some children, competition with the sibling may itself be motivating too. In many of the cases that have been studied, children with talented siblings also had one or both parents encouraging them as well. The Polgar sisters we know about, and Mozart, too. His father was not far behind Laszlo Polgar in his focus on developing a prodigy. Similarly, Serena and Venus Williams's father, Richard Williams, started them on tennis with the intention of turning them into tennis professionals. In such cases, It can be hard to disentangle the influence of the siblings from that of the parents, but it is probably no coincidence in these cases that it is generally the younger siblings who have reached greater heights. Part of it may be that the parents learn from their experiences with the older siblings and do a better job with the younger ones. But it is also likely that the presence of an older sibling fully engaged in an activity provides a number of advantages for the younger sibling. By watching an older sibling engaging in an activity, a younger child may become interested in and get started on that activity much sooner than he or she might otherwise. The older sibling can teach the younger one, and it can seem more like fun than lessons provided by the parent. And competition between siblings will likely be more helpful to the younger sibling than the older one, because the older one will naturally have greater skills, at least for a number of years. Bloom found a slightly different pattern in the early days of the children who would grow up to be mathematicians and neurologists than in the athletes, musicians, and artists. In this case, the parents didn't introduce the children to the particular subject matter, but rather to the appeal of intellectual pursuits in general. They encouraged their children's curiosity, and reading was a major pastime, with the parents reading to the children early on, and the children reading books themselves later. They also encouraged their children to build models or science projects, activities that could be considered educational, as part of their play. But whatever the specific details, the general pattern with these future experts was that at some point, they became very interested in a particular area and showed more promise than other children of a similar age. With Susan Polgar, that point came when she lost interest in the chess pieces simply as toys and became intrigued by the logic of how they moved around the board and interacted with other pieces during a game. At such a point, a child is ready to move to the next stage. Becoming serious. Once a future expert performer becomes interested and shows some promise in an area, the typical next step is to take lessons from a coach or teacher. At this point, most of these students encounter deliberate practice for the first time. Unlike their experiences up to this point, which have been mainly playful activities, their practice is about to become work. In general, the instructors who introduce the students to this sort of practice are not experts themselves, but they are good at working with children. They know how to motivate their students and keep them moving forward as they adapt to the work of improving through deliberate practice. These teachers are enthusiastic and encouraging and reward their students with praise or sometimes more concretely with candy or other small treats when the students have accomplished something. In the case of the Polgar sisters, Laszlo was their first teacher. He was not a particularly strong chess player. All of his daughters surpassed him well before their teenage years, but he knew enough to give them a good start on chess. And, most importantly, he kept them interested in the game. Judit has said that her father was the best motivator she had ever met, and this is perhaps the most important factor in the early days of an expert's development, maintaining that interest and motivation while the skills and habits are being built. Parents have an important role to play as well. In the Polgars' case, of course, Laszlo was both parent and teacher. Parents help their children establish routines, say, practicing the piano for an hour each day, and they give them support and encouragement and praise them for their improvements. They will, when necessary, push the children to prioritize their practice above other activities, practice first, play later. And if the children struggle too much to maintain their practice schedule, the parents may step in with more extreme measures. Some parents of Bloom's future experts had to resort to tactics like threatening to cut off piano lessons and sell the piano, or to no longer take the child to swim practice. Obviously, all of the future expert performers decided at this juncture that they wanted to keep going. Others might choose otherwise. While there are various ways that parents and teachers can motivate children, the motivation must ultimately be something that comes from within the child, or else it won't endure. Parents of small children can motivate them with praise and rewards, among other things, but eventually that will not be enough. One way that parents and teachers can provide long-term motivation is to help the children find related activities that they enjoy. For example, if a child discovers that he or she loves playing a musical instrument in front of an audience, that may be enough to motivate the child to put in the necessary practice. Helping children develop mental representations can also increase motivation by increasing their ability to appreciate the skill they are learning. Representations of music help a child better enjoy listening to music performances, and in particular, to enjoy playing one's favorite pieces for oneself in the practice room. Representations of chess positions lead to a greater appreciation of the beauty of the game. Representations of a baseball game allow a child to understand and admire the strategy that underlies the play. Bloom found a different pattern of interest and motivation among children who would become mathematicians, in large part because they started much later in their area of interest. Parents don't usually hire special tutors to instruct their 6-year-olds in mathematics. Instead, the future mathematicians first encountered serious mathematics courses, such as algebra, geometry, and calculus, in middle school and high school. And it was often the teachers in these courses, rather than their parents, who first stoked what would become their lifetime passion. The best teachers didn't focus on the rules for solving particular problems, but rather encouraged their students to think about general patterns and processes, the why more than the how. This was motivating to these children because it sparked an intellectual interest that would drive their studies, and later their research as mathematicians. Because these children were older and had become interested enough in the subject independent of their parents' influence, they needed little parental goading or encouragement to do homework and whatever else the teacher might suggest. One thing their parents did do was to emphasize the importance of academic success in general, and to make clear their expectations that their children would continue their schooling beyond high school and even beyond college. During the first part of this stage, the encouragement and support of parents and teachers was crucial to the child's progress. But eventually, the students began to experience some of the rewards of their hard work and became increasingly self-motivated. A piano student performed for others and appreciated the applause. A swimmer basked in the approval and respect of peers. These students became more vested in the process, and their self-image started to include those abilities that were setting them apart from their peers. In the case of team sports, like swimming, the students often relished being part of a group of like-minded people. But whatever the reasons, the motivation started to shift from external to internal in origin. Finally, as the students continued to improve, they started to seek out better qualified teachers and coaches who would take them to the next level. Piano students, for example, tended to move from a nearby teacher to the best teacher they could possibly reach, someone who often required an audition before accepting a student. Similarly, the swimmers would seek out the best coaches they could find, rather than the most conveniently located. With the step up in the level of instruction, the students also began to practice longer hours. The parents still provided support, such as paying for lessons and equipment, but the responsibility for the practice shifted almost entirely to the students themselves and their coaches and teachers. David Pariser, a researcher at Concordia University in Montreal, found a similar motivation in children who grew up to be gifted artists. They had a self-fueling, self-motivating drive for tremendous work, he reported, although they still required emotional and technical support from their parents and teachers. Bloom found that after 2 to 5 years at this stage, the future experts began to identify themselves more in terms of the skill they were developing and less in terms of other areas of interest, such as school or social life. They saw themselves as pianists or swimmers by the age of 11 or 12, or as mathematicians before they turned 16 or 17. They were becoming serious about what they did. Throughout these stages, and indeed throughout a person's life, it is difficult to untangle the various influences on motivation. There are certainly some intrinsic psychological factors that play a role, such as curiosity, and extrinsic factors, such as the support and encouragement of parents and peers. But too often we fail to acknowledge the neurological effects of actually doing the activity. We know that any sort of extended practice, playing chess or a musical instrument, learning mathematics, and so on, produces changes in the brain that lead to increased abilities in the skill being practiced. So it's reasonable to ask whether such practices also may produce changes in the brain structures that regulate motivation and enjoyment. We can't answer that question yet. But we do know that people who develop skills in a certain area through years of practice seem to get a great deal of pleasure from engaging in that skill. Musicians enjoy performing music. Mathematicians enjoy doing mathematics. Soccer players enjoy playing soccer. Of course, it is possible that this is completely due to a self-selection process, that the only people who would spend years practicing something are those who naturally love to do it. But it is also possible that the practice itself may lead to physiological adaptations that produce more enjoyment and more motivation to do that particular activity. That is nothing but speculation at this point, but it is reasonable speculation. Commitment. Generally, when they're in their early or mid-teens, the future experts make a major commitment to becoming the best that they can be. This commitment is the third stage. Now students will often seek out the best teachers or schools for their training, even if it requires moving across country. In most cases, that teacher will be someone who has reached the highest level in the field him or herself, a concert pianist turned teacher, a swimming coach who has trained Olympic athletes, a top research mathematician, and so on. It is generally not easy to be accepted into these programs. And acceptance means that the teacher shares the student's belief that he or she can reach the highest levels. The student faces expectations that gradually increase until the student is in essence doing as much as is humanly possible to improve. Swimmers are pushed to constantly improve on their personal best, and ultimately to pursue national and even international record times. Pianists are expected to perfect their performance on increasingly difficult pieces. Mathematicians are expected to demonstrate their mastery of an area by working on a problem that no one has ever solved before. None of this is expected immediately, of course, but it is always the ultimate goal: to get out to the edge of human ability and rank among the best. During this stage, the motivation lies solely with the student. But the family may still play an important support role. In the case of teenagers who move across country to train with a top coach, for instance, the family will often move too. And the training itself can be incredibly expensive, not just the cost of the teacher or coach, but equipment, transportation, and so on. In 2014, Money magazine estimated how much it cost a family to train a child who was an elite tennis player. Private lessons will cost $4,500 to $5,000, plus another $7,000 to $8,000 for group lessons. Court time will run you from $50 to $100 an hour. The entrance fee for a national tournament is about $150, plus transportation costs, and the best players compete in 20 or so tournaments a year. Bringing your coach along will cost another $300 a day, plus transportation, lodging, and meals. Add all that up, and it's easy to spend $30,000 a year. But many of the really serious students head off to tennis academies, where they train year-round, which can increase expenses dramatically. Attending the IMG Academy in Florida, for instance, will cost you $71,400 a year for tuition, room, and board, and you still have to pay to attend whatever tournaments you choose to play in. Not surprisingly, Bloom reported that very few families could afford to have more than one child pursue this level of performance. Not only is it expensive, but it can be almost a full-time job for a parent to support the student in this pursuit, driving to and from practice during the week, providing transportation to competitions on the weekend, and so on. However, the student who makes it to the end of this arduous road will have joined an elite cadre of people who can say, categorically, that they have reached the pinnacle of human achievement. The benefits of starting young. In Bloom's study, all 120 experts had begun their climb toward that pinnacle as children, which is typical among expert performers. But people frequently ask me what the possibilities are for someone who doesn't begin training until later in life. While the specific details vary by field, there are relatively few absolute limitations on what is possible for people who begin training as adults. Indeed, the practical limitations, such as the fact that few adults have 4 to 5 hours a day to devote to deliberate practice, are often more of an issue than any physical or mental limitations. However, expertise in some fields is simply unattainable for anyone who doesn't start training as a child. Understanding such limitations can help you decide which areas you might wish to pursue. The most obvious performance issues are those that involve physical abilities. In the general population, physical performance peaks around age 20. With increasing age, we lose flexibility, we become more prone to injury, and we take longer to heal. We slow down. Athletes typically attain their peak performance sometime during their 20s. Professional athletes can remain competitive in their 30s or even early 40s with recent advances in training. In fact, people can train effectively well into their 80s. Much of the age-related deterioration in various skills happens because people decrease or stop their training. Older people who continue to train regularly see their performance decrease much less. There are master's divisions in track and field competitions with age brackets up to 80 and beyond. And the people who train for these events do so in precisely the same way that people who are decades younger do. They just train for shorter periods with less intensity because of the increased risk of injury and the increased amount of time the body takes to recover from training. And with the realization that age is not the limitation it was once thought to be, more and more older adults are training harder and harder. Indeed, during the last few decades, the performance of master athletes has improved at a much higher rate than that of younger athletes. Today, for example, a quarter of marathon runners in their 60s can be expected to outperform more than half of their competitors between the ages of 20 and 54. One of the oldest people to participate in these masters events is Don Pellman, who in 2015 became the first person 100 years old or older to run 100 meters in less than 27 seconds. At the same track and field event, the San Diego Senior Olympics, Pellman set 4 other age group records as well, for the high jump, long jump, discus, and shot put. There are a number of athletes competing in Pellman's current age group, which includes competitors from 100 to 104. And the competitions include most of the events in any track and field competition, including the marathon. The world record time for the marathon in this age group is 8 hours 25 minutes 17 seconds, set by Fauja Singh of the United Kingdom in 2011. The times may be longer, the distances jumped may be shorter, and the heights cleared may be lower. But these athletes are still going. In addition to the gradual deterioration in physical abilities that accompanies aging, some physical skills simply cannot be developed to expert levels if one doesn't start working on them in childhood. The human body is growing and developing through adolescence up to the late teens or early 20s. But once we hit 20 or so, our skeletal structure is mostly set, which has implications for certain abilities. For example, if ballet dancers are to develop the classic turnout, the ability to rotate the entire leg beginning at the hip so that it points directly to the side, they must start early. If they wait until after their hip and knee joints calcify, which typically happens between the ages of 8 and 12 years, they'll probably never be able to get a full turnout. The same sort of thing is true for the shoulders of athletes, like baseball pitchers, whose sport requires them to throw a ball with an overhead motion. Only those who start training at an early age will have the requisite range of motion as adults, with the throwing arm able to be stretched well back behind the shoulder to produce the classic windup. And something similar holds true with the motion tennis players use when serving. Only those who start young have the full range of the serving motion. Professional tennis players who start young also overdevelop the forearm they use to hold the racket, not just the muscles, but the bones as well. The bones in a tennis player's dominant arm can be 20% thicker than the bones in his or her other arm, a huge difference that allows the bones in the dominant arm to endure the steady jolting that comes with hitting a tennis ball that may be traveling as fast as 50 miles per hour. However, even tennis players who start later in life, in their 20s, still can adapt to some degree, but just not as much as those who start younger. In other words, our bones retain their ability to change in response to stress well beyond puberty. We witness this pattern again and again when we examine the relationship between age and the body's ability to adapt to stresses or other stimuli. The body and the brain both are more adaptable during childhood and adolescence than they are in adulthood. But in most ways, they remain adaptable to some degree throughout life. The relationship between age and adaptability varies considerably according to exactly which characteristic you have in mind, and the patterns are very different for mental adaptations than for physical ones. Consider the various ways that musical training can affect the brain. Studies have shown that some parts of the brain are larger in musicians than in non-musicians, but there are certain parts of the brain for which this is true only if the musician began studying music as a young child. Researchers have found proof of this, for example, in the corpus callosum, the collection of tissue that connects the brain's hemispheres and serves as the communications path between them. The corpus callosum is significantly larger in adult musicians than in adult non-musicians. But a closer look finds that it is really only larger in musicians who started practicing before they were 7. Since the initial publication of these findings in the 1990s, research has uncovered a number of other regions of the brain that are larger in musicians than in non-musicians, but only if the musicians started training before a certain age. Many of those regions are related to muscle control, such as the sensorimotor cortices. On the other hand, some parts of the brain involved in the control of movements, such as the cerebellum, are larger in musicians than in non-musicians, but show no difference in size between musicians who started music training later and those who started earlier. We don't know exactly what is going on in the cerebellum, but the implication would seem to be that musical training can affect the cerebellum in a noticeable way, even when the training starts after childhood. How adult brains learn is a relatively new and rather exciting field of study, and it is upending traditional beliefs that our brains become static once adolescence ends. The general lesson is that we can certainly acquire new skills as we age, but the specific way in which we acquire those skills changes as we get older. The human brain has the greatest amount of gray matter, the tissue containing neurons, the nerve fibers that connect the neurons, and the neuron support cells, during early adolescence, at which point the brain starts paring down that gray matter. The synapses, the junctions between nerve cells, reach a maximum number early in life. A 2-year-old child has about 50% more synapses than an adult. The specific details are not so important to us here as the general fact that the brain is constantly developing and changing through the first couple of decades of life, and so the background against which learning takes place is also changing. Thus, it makes sense that a 6-year-old's brain learns differently than a 14-year-old's brain, which learns differently than an adult brain, even if all of them are learning the same thing. Consider what happens to the brain when it learns multiple languages. It is well known that people who speak 2 or more languages have more gray matter in certain parts of the brain, in particular the inferior parietal cortex, which is known to play a role in language, and that the earlier a person learned a second language, the more extra gray matter there is. Thus, learning languages early in life takes place, it seems, at least in part through adding gray matter. But a study of multilingual people who, as adults, studied to become simultaneous interpreters, found a very different effect on the brain. These simultaneous interpreters actually had less gray matter than people who could speak the same number of languages, but who didn't work as simultaneous interpreters. The researchers who carried out the study speculated that this disparity was because of the different contexts in which the learning took place. When children and adolescents learn new languages, it is against the backdrop of increasing gray matter, and so their learning the additional languages may occur through the addition of gray matter. but when adults continue their focus on multiple languages, this time with an emphasis on simultaneous translation, it is against a backdrop of pruning synapses. Thus, the language learning that takes place in adulthood may take place more through getting rid of gray matter, getting rid of some inefficient nerve cells to speed up processes, which would explain why the simultaneous interpreters had less gray matter than other multilingual adults. At this point, there are more questions than there are answers about the differences in learning among brains of various ages. But for our purposes, there are two lessons to carry away. First, while the adult brain may not be as adaptable in certain ways as the brain of the child or adolescent, it is still more than capable of learning and changing. And second, since the adaptability of the adult brain is different from the adaptability of the young brain, learning as an adult is likely to take place through somewhat different mechanisms. But if we adults try hard enough, our brains will find a way. More lessons from perfect pitch. As an example of how the adult brain can find a way, consider perfect pitch, the example of brain adaptability that we began this book with. As I discussed, it seemed that there is an age past which it is very difficult, if not impossible, to develop perfect pitch. If you do the proper training before you turn 6, you are more likely to develop perfect pitch. If you wait until you're 12, you'll be out of luck. At least that is the standard telling of the tale. It turns out there is one more twist, and it is a very instructive one. In 1969, Paul Brady, a researcher at the old Bell Telephone Laboratories, set out on what must have appeared to most to be a quixotic undertaking. At the time, he was 32 years old, and he had been involved in music all his life. He'd played the piano since he was 7, he had sung in choruses since he was 12, and he even tuned his own harpsichord. But he had never had perfect pitch, or anything close. He had never been able to tell which note on the piano or harpsichord was being played. And because he was an adult, everything that was known about perfect pitch at the time indicated that he had lost his chance. He would never develop perfect pitch, no matter how hard he tried. But Brady was not the sort to believe something was true just because everyone said it was. When he was 21, he decided he would try to teach himself to recognize notes. For 2 weeks, he would play an A on his piano and try to remember what it sounded like. No luck. When he would come back a while later, he couldn't tell an A from a B or a C or a G sharp. A few years later, he tried again with a similar technique and similar results. When he was 32, he decided to try again, this time vowing that he would keep working at it until he succeeded. He tried everything he could think of. He spent hours thinking about notes and playing pieces in his head, trying to hear what distinguished one note from another. Nothing. He tried playing piano pieces in different keys with the hope that he could learn to tell the difference between the different keys. Still nothing. After 3 months, he was no closer to perfect pitch than when he had started. Then he was inspired by a paper that described a training technique that had helped musicians without perfect pitch learn to recognize a single note. Brady set up a computer to produce random, pure tones. These are tones that consist of a single frequency, unlike a note from a piano, which has a dominant frequency, but also a number of other frequencies as well. And he used those pure tones to practice. At first, he had a large percentage of randomly generated tones at the frequency of a C note, theorizing that if he could learn to recognize the C, he could use it as a base from which to recognize the other tones by their relationship to the C. Over time, as he got better and better at recognizing the C, the computer was set up to generate fewer and fewer of the Cs until all 12 notes were being generated with equal frequency. Brady spent half an hour each day training with the tone generator, and at the end of 2 months he could identify every one of the 12 notes being played without error. Then, to test whether he had actually trained himself to have perfect pitch, he devised a test with a piano. Each day his wife would play one random note on the piano and he would try to identify it. She did this for almost 2 months, 57 days to be exact. and at the end, Brady looked to see how he had done. He had gotten 37 exactly right. He had missed 18 by just half a tone, a B-flat instead of a B, for instance, and 2 by a full tone. Not perfect, but pretty close. Furthermore, the technical definition of perfect pitch actually allows a certain percentage of answers that are off by half a tone, and many people who are accepted by researchers as having perfect pitch actually make such errors themselves. So by the literal definition of perfect pitch, and by any practical definition as well, Brady had taught himself, with 2 months of the right sort of practice, to have perfect pitch. The article that Brady wrote describing his accomplishment got relatively little attention over the following decades, probably because he was just one person, and he had done the experiment on himself. And researchers continued to assert that there was no convincing evidence that adults could develop perfect pitch. In the mid-1980s, a graduate student at Ohio State University, Mark Allen Rush, set out to test that claim with a carefully controlled study that attempted to develop perfect pitch in a group of adults. He decided to use a system designed by David Lucas Burge, who offered a training course that he claimed could help anyone develop perfect pitch. The course, which is still being sold today, spoke about the colors of different notes and asked students to listen to notes in such a way that they were paying attention not to such things as the loudness or timbre of the notes, but rather their color. Rush recruited 52 undergraduate music majors, half of whom would take Burge's course in an effort to develop perfect pitch, and half of whom would do nothing. Rush tested their ability to identify notes before and after a 9-month period, during which half of the students were working with Burge's course. Rush's results were not exactly a ringing endorsement of Burge's methods, but they offered encouraging evidence about the possibility of improving one's ability to recognize notes. At the end of the 9-month period, the control group scores were, not surprisingly, pretty much identical with their scores beforehand. But among the other group, a number of undergraduates had improved their judgment about notes. The test involved a total of 120 notes, and Rush kept track both of how many notes they got right and how far off they were on their wrong answers. The student who saw the biggest improvement was also the student who started off with the best ear. That student got about 60 right on the first test and more than 100 right on the second, good enough to be described as having perfect pitch. But then that student had been well on his way before the training. 3 other students who had relatively poor scores on the first test got much better on the second, doubling or tripling the number of right answers and making far fewer significant errors. The rest of the 26 students improved slightly or stayed the same. But it was clear from the pattern of improvement that the skill of recognizing notes could indeed be trained in adults, at least some adults, and that if the training were continued, or if perhaps a more effective approach were used, a number of those subjects might well have developed perfect pitch. This is a very different picture than the traditional one, which sees perfect pitch as an either-or proposition. Either you develop it as a child, or you never will. It may require a great deal of work, and it's possible that some adults may still never be able to do it. But it now appears that at least some adults can develop perfect pitch. Pathbreakers. In 1997, a New Zealander named Nigel Richards entered his country's national Scrabble championship. To everyone's surprise, he won. 2 years later, he entered the World Scrabble Championship in Melbourne, Australia. He won again. Richards went on to dominate competitive Scrabble. He has won the World Championship 3 times, the U.S. National Championship 5 times, the U.K. Open 6 times, and the King's Cup in Bangkok, the largest Scrabble competition in the world, 12 times. He has achieved the highest Scrabble rating ever. And perhaps most remarkable of all, he won the 2015 French Scrabble Championship without even being able to speak the language. He took 9 weeks to memorize the words from the French Scrabble dictionary, and he was ready. The Scrabble world had never seen anything quite like Nigel Richards. but other fields certainly have. Many of the names are familiar: Beethoven, Van Gogh, Newton, Einstein, Darwin, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods. These are the people whose contributions leave their fields forever changed. The pathfinders who lead the way into new territory so that others can follow. This is the fourth stage of expert performance, where some people move beyond the existing knowledge in their field and make unique, creative contributions. It is the least well understood of the four stages, and the most intriguing. One thing we do know about these innovators is that they almost without exception have worked to become expert performers in their fields before they started breaking new ground. It makes sense that this should be so. After all, how are you going to come up with a valuable new theory in science or a useful new technique on the violin if you are not intimately familiar with and able to reproduce the accomplishments of those who preceded you? This is true even in those fields where it might not be so obvious that new inventions are always built upon older ones. Take Pablo Picasso. Someone who only knows his later, more famous paintings could reasonably conclude that they must have sprung directly from a mind untouched by earlier artistic traditions, because they looked so unlike anything from those traditions. In reality, Picasso began painting in an almost classical style, a style at which he was very accomplished. Over time, he explored various other artistic styles, then combined them and modified them to develop his own style. But he had worked long and hard to develop himself as a painter and excel at the techniques his predecessors had mastered. But where does such creativity ultimately come from? Is it not a whole other level beyond deliberate practice, which is, after all, based on practicing things in ways that other people have figured out in order to develop skills of the sort that others have already developed? I don't believe so. Having studied many examples of creative genius, it's clear to me that much of what expert performers do to move the boundary of their fields and create new things is very similar to what they're doing to reach that boundary in the first place. Consider this. Those experts who are at the very boundary of their professions, the best mathematicians, the top-ranked grandmasters in the world, the golfers who win major tournaments, the international touring violinists, didn't achieve their heights just by imitating their teachers. For one thing, most of them at this stage have already surpassed their teachers. The most important lesson they gleaned from their teachers is the ability to improve on their own. As part of their training, their teachers helped them develop mental representations that they could use to monitor their own performances, figure out what needs improving, and come up with ways to realize that improvement. These mental representations, which they are constantly sharpening and augmenting, are what guides them toward greatness. You can picture the process as building a ladder, step by step. You climb as high as you can and build one more step at the top of the ladder. Climb up one more step, build another step, and so on. Once you get to the edge of your field, you may not know exactly where you're headed, but you know the general direction. And you have spent a good deal of your life building this ladder, so you have a good sense of what it takes to add on one more step. Researchers who study how the creative geniuses in any field, science, art, music, sports, and so on, come up with their innovations, have found that it is always a long, slow, iterative process. Sometimes these pathbreakers know what they want to do, but don't know how to do it, like a painter trying to create a particular effect in the eye of the viewer. So they explore various approaches to find one that works. And sometimes they don't know exactly where they're going, but they recognize a problem that needs a solution, or a situation that needs improving, like mathematicians trying to prove an intractable theorem, and again they try different things, guided by what has worked in the past. There are no big leaps, only developments that look like big leaps to people from the outside, because they haven't seen all of the little steps that comprise them. Even the famous aha moments could not exist without a great deal of work to build an edifice that needs just one more piece to make it complete. Furthermore, research on the most successful creative people in various fields, particularly science, finds that creativity goes hand in hand with the ability to work hard and maintain focus over long stretches of time. Exactly the ingredients of deliberate practice that produced their expert abilities in the first place. For example, a study of Nobel Prize winners found that they had generally published scientific papers earlier than most of their peers, and that they published significantly more papers throughout their careers than others in their discipline. In other words, they worked harder than everyone else. Creativity.